one or other songs. And at that time, the recording engineer said, "This is not your voice." So he offered to come to one of our churches, where my accompanist was also an organist, and we would record. So we did record it. But after that he said, "You can see that I don't have the best equipment." And that's when I realized that God did not want it. So gradually my life changed. But I do have to say that I did offend the Lord. But then the Lord took me back. So you see, I'm not a pedestal saint. But I saw then that God was going to burn all my bridges, not my britches. And that's exactly what happened. I was moved then to the seminary in Hamilton, Massachusetts for 2 years. It was a gradual reorientation to a deeper life with the Lord. I taught in the seminary. I did preaching engagements near Boston. I had 9-day novenas. I had conducted Marian rallies. But then I was moved from there back to the Allegheny Mountains for 6 years. And it was during that time, too, that I went through another trying time. Again, personalities, prayer dryness, a number of things worked in. But God kind of purifying you. At that time, we had opened up a contemplative house in the Alps of Austria. I thought about it, but I didn't have the opportunity, nor did I think I could endure it. The schedule they had outlined was quite austere. But as the house persevered over those 6 years, at the end of my 6 years there, I began to prepare myself to go. I began to get back to more time in prayer. And then I asked permission to go for 1 year. And my superior gave the permission. I think at this time, for this... I left out a few things before I came to my second assignment to our monastery in New Baltimore, Pennsylvania. After I'd left Chicago, having taught there for 7 years, I went to our junior seminary in Hamilton, Massachusetts, where I taught the seminaries for 2 years, took over the choir, played the organ at the Mass, and also conducted Marian rallies occasionally, and gave talks in Boston on the missions and so forth. I then went to New Baltimore, where I spent 6 years, and at that time, I had already completed my work at the conservatory, had my degree, and at that time I began to do these recordings that you now have. Brother Anthony, being blind, was also going deaf, partially. So I had to play the music for him, four bars at a time, and then he'd memorize it. And after quite a while, we would put the piece together. And eventually we ended up with 30 pieces on that tape. I had to teach him the accompaniment for the operatic numbers too. Not that I play that well, but I could at least play a few bars. And he picked it up quickly. And that is how we did our recording. We had our recording sessions in the community room where there was a baby grand piano. And we usually wait when the novices who were there were out on a walk so there'd be no noise to disturb the recording. We didn't have ideal recording equipment like we have today, but as good enough as you could hear. It came over well enough to hear the best part of it. And that's how we did all these songs. I was going to use them for auditioning purposes. And then is when the Lord gave me the nudge to go to Austria. So that was back in 1960, and some of you have seen that album. It was hard for my mother because she wasn't sure she would be living when I came back. She was in her early 70s. She did die while I was over there because I was there 9 years. And it kind of wrung my heart, too, because she really put pressure on me. And she wanted to know why I was going and couldn't I stay. And, you know, some mothers can really put on the pressure. But I had to be very honest, and I sensed that it was a deep call from the Lord, and I had to do it. And it wasn't for reasons of penance, but it was there to really realize my deepest vocation. So my trip over there was by sea. I never went over the Atlantic by sea. In fact, it was my first trip. And of course, I wanted to go on the best. At that time, it was 1960. Remember, that's 26 years ago on the SS United States, which was in very, very good shape at that time. And we made the trip across the Atlantic in 4.5 days. So fast that they had to park out of Cherbourg Harbor for I don't know how many hours, otherwise they'd have to pay $10,000 an hour. So we waited for a number of hours, and then we went into the harbor. Well, at any rate, I did a number of things. I went to Lourdes, I went to Lucerne, Switzerland, and I also traveled somewhat in Germany, and then finally ended up in Austria. And there I went to Vienna, and then finally went to the little mountain town of Welfnitz, 9 miles from a town called Griffin, and it's a 30-mile distance from the border of Yugoslavia. The monastery was on a mountainside at a level of 4,000 feet. They cut a ledge into the mountain. It was not rocky, it was wooded. And the monastery was built in the ideal location, so the sun was never into the window, but over the monastery, just over the top of the monastery. And it was facing 3 ranges of the Alps in front of you. And it was built in order to accommodate at the most about 15. We never had that many at any time. It was like a Swiss chalet. You saw pictures. Many of you saw the picture. Beautiful type monastery. But the life was not an entirely community life. It was intended to be immensely prayerful. And it was not, you didn't go for a vacation. You didn't go to ski. And you didn't go to just mosey around. You didn't go to preach either. You went for one thing, to pray and to fast and to endure. So the schedule was very trying. To start at midnight. We got up at midnight, 12 o'clock. Well, I got up at 11:45. I always rang the bell. And they didn't like me for that. No, they were all very generous people. You didn't come there because you were sent there to do a penance. You had to come voluntarily. So we prayed what we call the matins in the chapel for the better part of about 40 minutes. And if you wanted to stay up more after that, you were free to do so. But you had to be up by 5 in the morning. So in all the time you were there, you always had a broken sleep. Never more than 3 hours before midnight, and never more than 4 hours after. And obviously, some did not adjust to that very easily. I don't think you ever did. It was always a penance to wake up, you know, in dead sleep, because by 12 o'clock, you were in dead sleep. You wanted to or should have retired by 9 o'clock, so that you would have 3 hours of sleep. Before the midnight office. And then we were up at 5. We had what they call the morning hour today, morning prayer, followed by 1 hour of mental prayer. And then those priests who were not going to celebrate the community mass celebrated their own masses. We served each other. And then after that, we had breakfast, which consisted of a couple of pieces of bread, and we sometimes had butter, and we had a coffee that was like chicory. I called it Kickapoo juice. And I would write to my mother to send us over some instant coffee. And when that came, we treated it like gold. We only had it on Sunday. And that was our breakfast. Then we washed dishes. We took turns washing, serving table. We had a cook. They always asked for a volunteer. When they asked me to do the cooking, I said, "It'll be your last meal." So they never asked me again. The rest of the schedule, after the breakfast and dishes were done, table set for dinner, we would go up to chapel and have the community mass. We always sang the entire Gregorian chant proper. I know because I directed them, and I did the singing, the cantors, and usually took them through the previous day's singing or the following day's singing in the afternoon. We always prepared beforehand. We sang the entire thick book like that, 1,800 pages of chant. Beautiful, but now it's lost. At any rate, the community mass lasted sometimes about 45 minutes or an hour. And then we were free to go to our room to study and to pray if we wanted to, or just to do some work. And it was at that time that I began to do some work on a book that was eventually published by Alba House called Prayer, Aspiration, Contemplation, a assembly of writings from one of our Carmelites, John of St. Sampson, died in France. He's the John of the Cross of France. And that's how I occupied many of my free hours. However, the life had to be balanced. You couldn't be at your desk or praying all the time. That kind of life requires working with your hands too. You must do some kind of physical labor. Otherwise, you get too lost in yourself. So there were times when we had a farm attached to the monastery in order to finance our livelihood and also to supply our food. We had potatoes. So we picked potatoes, back-breaking. You picked them by hand. But after a while, they had a potato machine. So that kind of absolved us from that kind of work. But then there was a vegetable garden that a brother took over, and we had all kinds of vegetables, including strawberries. We had cabbage. We had Brussels sprouts. In the winter time, he'd take an axe, go out and chop a stem of Brussels sprouts and bring it in. We had our deep freeze right out in the open. And he had a coal frame for the cabbage and the carrots and so forth. So we had everything except corn and tomatoes, I believe. At that height, you couldn't raise corn. Well, to get back to the schedule, at 11:30, we went to the chapel again for what is called terce. That's a mid-morning prayer lasting about 20 minutes. Then we went to dinner. We had a full dinner in the afternoon. And that was usually a good meal, but the only full meal you had. The cooking was done by either an Italian who was there, or a German brother, or one of the Dutch Carmelites who had some brothers. They did the cooking. And after that, we were free for about an hour. They called that a siesta. If you wanted to, you could sleep, or if you didn't want to, you could do whatever you like, go out and walk a bit, or do some reading. But at 2 o'clock, we went to the chapel again for another hour of prayer. Not an hour, but about 20 minutes. And then I would take them through the choir practice for the next morning's mass. And then from that time on, we were free until 4:30. Then we did work outside of different kinds. Some did painting. I did the landscaping. I had the three flower gardens. Some of you saw them. And I also had charge of the chapel. I scrubbed the floors, waxed the floors. I even washed the walls. And also laid out the vestments, took care of mass intentions, in addition to the choir work. And then I did the landscaping. Landscaping meant you push that lawnmower, cut the grass. And we didn't have concrete walks. They were just plain dirt walks that often filled up with weeds. So I went out and chopped them down so we could at least walk. And cultivated the garden. And that took up some of my hours in the afternoon. But by 4:30, you had to be in, and we were back in the chapel, this time for the evening prayer and another hour of prayer, mental prayer. So there were at least 2 hours of mental prayer each day that the community was obligated to. And that was followed by a light lunch in the evening. During Lent, we had very light food. All you had maybe was a good slice of bread, two sardines, and tea if you wanted it, or that Kickapoo juice, and maybe you had an apple, and that was lunch. Now, if you ate much more, when you got up at midnight, you'd be like a zombie. A full meal would not take on that kind of schedule and that kind of awakening, because it takes a while for your digestion to work on a heavy meal. So we found that that was very suitable. Those that came for the first time and did not follow that regime, they were zombies when they woke up at midnight, and they paid the price. But the silence also was voluntary in the sense that nobody was placed under obligation to keep absolute silence. It was respected. You were allowed to talk if there was such a need, but quietly. And that was always usually respected. So you had... So getting back to the evening. After supper, then, we went to the chapel and had the night prayer. That was called Compline, which took about 20 minutes, ending with a hymn to Our Lady, the Salve Regina, which we sang all the time. And then it was nighttime. We all retired to our room, and you maybe study for an hour, but by 9 o'clock, if you were wise, you went to bed. So then 9 o'clock to 11:45, I was up ringing the bell, and that's the full day. So that's what we did for 9 years, or at least I did. And that was the schedule. So we had Carmelites from all over the world. I would say except possibly Australia and Indonesia. But we had Germans, we had Spanish, we had Italians, we had Irishmen, and we had Americans. And don't know who else. I think that was all that we had, at least in my time. Because the life was so austere, not everybody wanted to come. At the most, we had 11 in my time. And then it dwindled down to 7, 5, 4, and in the last year that I was there, there were only 3. Because Vatican II had taken place, now the language of the house was always Latin, the liturgy had changed, the cost of it was on my own province, at least $25,000 a year to maintain that. Mass stipends over there, you couldn't live on them. In Austria, the mass stipend is 40 cents. So I had to write back here to our provincial and ask him to send American stipends. And they were always very generous. And that's what helped to buy our food and pay our electricity and our bills. And sometimes donations that came otherwise. But because Vatican II had changed so many things, our order had decided that we should set up houses of prayer in our own provinces. So, sadly, I had, by the 6th year that I was there, decided to stay there for the rest of my life. But as the years wore on, and things began to change drastically, they suddenly realized that this would be a burden to maintain such a house, so they decided to sell it. I really cried, because I was already decided to stay there. But God had other plans, and so they tried to sell it to the communities around there. Not even the communities together had enough money to buy it. It was built at a cost of $100,000. After 12 years, we were selling it down to $10,000. And even then, they couldn't buy it. And then I've told that the farmers around there eventually all pitched in together and bought it. But sad to say, they turned it into a community house. The cross was taken down, They're Catholic, but the cross was taken down, the chapel altar was removed, and of course all our things were taken and sent to Rome. We had a library in five languages, but all the books were taken out. I took some books with me. But at this point, I don't know what it is now. But certainly it was a very blessed place. In those 9 years, I have to say they were the hardest years of my life, because it was another kind of purification that I'd never gone through before. And I didn't know how long that would last. Yet as in my first year, I only signed up for 1 year. I didn't think I could last that kind of life. But in the first year that I was there, I found so much consolation. It was just like back in my novitiate day. And I was a little naive, thinking that, wow, it's going to be pretty cozy and glorious. But I was soon undeceived, because the Lord was more or less telling me this was not going to be a bed of roses, that there was still a way to go. And again, it was not anything extraordinary, like getting visions of hell and all that kind of thing. It was just an accumulation of personalities. I look into the lives of the saints, you'll see it was people who often helped to purify the saints. So it's we, one another, who do that, even in spite of ourselves. So there was a conflict of personalities. Again, I was far from perfect. And put that together, plus hours of prayer, when you have many, many hours to look at yourself and you say, yeah, is that me? Lord, please. Well, in that kind of life, you either have to face up to yourself or you get out, because you can't stand it. And I thank God that I was able to, but some who came couldn't, for different reasons. They couldn't take the silence. They needed someone to talk to all the time, and that became a problem. Had to go home. But those times, all those days, there were ups and downs. There were glorious times of nearness to God. There were times when God seemed a million miles away. Times when prayer was the hardest thing in the world. It's bad enough if you gave a half hour, but if you had to spend 7 hours in the chapel every day, then prayer became very painful. And if you had to sing it and direct it, it also became painful. And you always didn't get the kind of cooperation that you'd wanted. And being a musician, I placed expectations on others that sometimes they couldn't meet. And then just dealing with myself, having to look back over my own life, having to see things now as God wanted me to see them, all that is very humbling, and it throws you on God's mercy. There are all kinds of temptations. Believe me, some of the most terrible temptations against chastity were over there. Not when I'm here and I see all kinds of God's people of the opposite sex over there, where you're away from it all. And that's where Satan can kind of build up a hunger on your own humanness, and that you have to deal with it. And then there are other temptations against despair, that you can never overcome your faults, and that others are down on you, and that you can endure this life. Sometimes there were depressions, periods of depression, when I hated to even get up for the day, knowing what it would be like, and just enduring it. There's no answer to that except to go through it. Besides, where could I go? I was 3,000 miles away from my own, 5,000 miles away, and I couldn't call up the provincial and say, hey, send a plane over here and get me back. I wasn't about to do that. Because I realized that that's where the Lord wanted me. So, putting it all together, I sensed that as my greatest purification. Towards the end of that last year, 2 years there, I one day had an experience that I could now approach either person of the Blessed Trinity or all three, and I felt a familiarity with the Blessed Trinity. And there was a peace that began to come into my life. And ever since that time, it's never left me. I've had upsets now and then, but never lasting for any length of time. And I have good reason to believe that my years over there have made what I'm doing now blessed, because I believe what the Lord did then helped me to be the kind of instrument that I hope that I am, that He wants me to be now. So when I came back, because first of all, there were only three, the house was sold, I came back, of all places, to the place I left in 1960, the Allegheny Mountains. In the meantime, they emptied that house. It was a four-story monastery of 40 rooms, empty. They had a parish there, left only one priest, had another priest to serve as a mission. So there were only two priests there when I left a community of 50 people. So in 1969, in 9 years, the place was practically empty. All the furniture was given away. So I came there hoping to set up a house of prayer, which I did. At first, there was no response. Then I wrote to the superior, was the superior there at one time, but the novice master, who said that we should set up houses of prayer. And I said to him, well, then put your foot where your mouth is and come and join me. So he did. And another companion came, and so we set up a house of prayer. In the meantime, became aware of the charismatic renewal. And I began to explore it. I wrote to everybody I knew about it, but not to anyone. I wrote to all theologians. Some of you know the Abbot Jarrett of Pecos. At that time, he was in Illinois. I wrote to him. I wrote to Edward O'Connor, who was involved with all the leaders at that time. I wrote to Romeus O'Brien, Dean of Canon Law, Carmelite at Washington, D.C., Catholic University, to Ernest Larkin, also a theologian in the Charismatic Renewal, and to Howard Rafferty, Carmelite who started a prayer group in 1968. All said they thought the Charismatic Renewal was a great blessing of God. It had its problems, but it was a great blessing, and that it was a renewal. On their word and my own reading and discernment, I decided to become part of it. So I went to Notre Dame in 1970. Three Carmelites were with me. One of them is a theologian today. One has died and the other is still living. And I asked them to pray over me and asked them to pray for me that I would receive the baptism of the Spirit. I knew very little about tongues. I read about the other gifts, but I hoped that I would be open. And so the three of them prayed over me and asked that I would receive, and I asked for two gifts. I asked for the gift of discernment and the gift of healing. And I've reason to believe God has given me more than that since. So they prayed over me, and nothing happened. Now you're shocked. Nothing happened, because it already happened in 1936. My baptism in the Spirit took place then. See? If I knew how to pray in tongues at that time, I probably would have burst out. But I had reservations about that gift because I had studied 8 languages and I knew all the sounds in Greek and Hebrew, Latin and German, Italian, French, Spanish, Croatian and English. Now, what sound could I make that didn't fit any word in one of these languages? So I had misgivings about me making it up. So I said, Lord, if you want me to have that gift of tongues, it's going to have to burst out of me, in spite of me. So I was waiting for the day when this would happen, see? And here the Lord's going to give me the gift. And I'm saying, okay, Lord, give it to me. Boom, okay, Lord, I accept it. Well, nothing like that ever happened. And I was waiting 2 years. Meantime, I was brash enough to pray for others that received the gift of tongues. And the Lord pulled a fast one on me because I was thinking, well, just how are you going to do that healing business? And here a nun comes up to me at the Notre Dame conference the first time I was there. That was right after they prayed with me the baptism of the Spirit. And she asked if I could pray with her to receive the gift of tongues. I said, sure. So we went up to the classroom and I prayed over and I said, Lord, please give her this gift. that without telling her, I said to myself and to the Lord, I said, Lord, give her what she needs. Well, here I was thinking, what kind of healing? And she didn't tell me she needed a healing. So I went to Frances McNutt's healing workshop the next day. She sat in the same row. After the workshop, she came over to me wide-eyed, and she said, Father, I didn't get the gift of tongues. I almost said, praise the Lord, but I didn't. And but she said, I think a miracle has happened. I have good reason to think I have skin cancer, and I've already made an arrangement to go to a skin clinic after this conference. I don't have it anymore. And here I was thinking, how is the Lord going to use me? And here I didn't even know it. And the message was, my son, I'm the healer, not you. So here I was exploring the renewal in different circles. I started right at the top. I know Ralph Martin, knew him quite well. I met Steve Clark. And I knew Father George Kosicki, stayed with them in their community in Detroit for about a week, eventually shared with them my book on the prayer of love. And at that time, Father George said, would you please give me these notes? And I said, George, I think you better wait if I can publish it. I'd rather wait. So did Ralph Martin, wanted me to make the tape available. I shared with the leaders at that time, all the leaders of well known, and their wives in their home at Ann Arbor. I spent the better part of the whole day sharing with them what eventually became my prayer of love, the art of aspiration. And at one of the conferences, the Lord used me in a kind of prophetic teaching for the leaders at that time. They had a prayer meeting about, I think they were, had almost had 600 of the leaders from all over the country at that time. Maybe not that many at that time, not quite sure. At any rate, the teaching or the prophecies had to do with the Lord teaching the leaders through prayer. And as the prophecies developed, a whole teaching developed in my mind with an urge to share it. And I needed to discern, because here I was a newcomer. I would be thrusting myself on them without having much knowledge of prayer groups. So I had to think, is this me or is it the Lord? I knew something about prophecy, but there was such an urge in me that I can hardly hold back. And I waited towards the end of the conference or the prayer meeting when there was a silence. And it was so urgent, I almost catapulted out of the chair. And I shared with them what it was, that the Lord does heal, he does teach, he is the doctor of souls in prayer. Prayer is a school. It is also a fire where God purifies. And I went and said a number of things. And afterwards, a number of the leaders came up to me and said, one sister came to me and she said, Father, I got the same message, but I was told someone else was going to give it. See, it was a confirmation. And a number of the leaders come up to say how happy they were to hear that. On that response, I asked Ralph Martin if later on that evening I could have, or the next day I could have a workshop on prayer and contemplation. He agreed. So we announced it, and that evening about 100 of the leaders came. I talked from 8 o'clock till 12 o'clock. They were so thirsty, they couldn't get enough. And I just talked and talked, and they asked questions, and that's what it led to. So I got to know many of the leaders, and in that time, those early 5-6 years, I went to many places. I gave retreats in Chicago to the Aylesford Community Prayer Group, to a large sisterhood that had charismatic sisters. I gave a workshop at the Notre Dame Conference on Our Lady in conjunction with a workshop given by Father Howard Rafferty. I was one of the speakers there. Also gave a workshop in Atlantic City on prayer and contemplation. And knew all the leaders here in Jersey. I don't know that many here now. I'm not that involved except in the kind of work I'm doing now. But I have had prayer groups everywhere that I've gone. And also even led a Methodist prayer group before I left Pennsylvania. And at that time, they came into tongues at the time. They came into prophecy, interpretation of tongues. as I was leading them and helped them to come into these gifts. So they were very open. And I also gave retreats in Maryland, charismatic retreats almost all the time. I gave I gave talks to the original prayer group in Pittsburgh. I know a number of the leaders personally and still know them, and have been invited any time that I go there to minister to the prayer group. I also have given a kind of universal day of prayer to the prayer groups in Baltimore, Maryland. All the prayer groups there came for a day of prayer, and precisely on what I gave at Wanta, the prayer of love, the art of aspiration. They loved it. So I've given, in other words, charismatic retreats, days of prayer to prayer groups, to leaders, also in Allentown, Pennsylvania, in the early days of 1972. Brother Pankey, remember him? Some of you know him from Philadelphia. Vincent Walsh, he is the Vice Chancellor of Philadelphia Archdiocese. And also Michael Scanlon, many of you know him in Steubenville. I knew him back in 1969 in Loretto when he started a prayer group and invited me to come and to share with their group. We worked together in a workshop in Philadelphia with Brother Pankey and some of the other leaders. So I was involved with some of the leaders who are now on a national, international level, and they know me. So I've had personal, first-hand experience in the charismatic renewal and all the gifts, and I've always been in admiration at mature groups and how they respond, how the Lord can use them, and you have to see that and be with them when they have the word of knowledge, when they have prophecy in tongues, and immediately somebody else responds in an interpretation. That's what it ought to be. And then healing, how all the group prays together for healing, and they have a healing team. When you see all that, you have to say, this is a renewed church. This is what the church will be in the future. And when you know what it's done in countless lives, then you have to say, this is not exclusive. A renewal in love is not for a few people, it's for all of God's people. That's what the charismatic renewal really is. Not just charismatic gifts. Essentially, basically, it is a renewal in love. Then the others follow. If the love isn't there, St. Paul says, it's nothing. If I have the tongues of men and angels, he said, I have not love, I'm nothing. So basically, charismatic renewal is a renewal in love, and then the gifts come with it. Then we respond. So this gift of tongues is important. And when I pray here and pray individually with some of you, that's the way I pray, in tongues. To this day, I don't know what I'm saying, but I know that I believe it's the Holy Spirit praying in me. And as we believe when we pray in this gift, that in each of you who pray that way, it is the Spirit who prays through you and in you. So over these years now, in 15 years, I began to move definitely into what we call the healing mass. Back in 1972, I was a suspect that this healing mass business was something underground. And I was under heavy suspicion. But the Lord moved me gradually from New Baltimore to a place in New Philadelphia in Pennsylvania, then to Lower Jersey in Camden, where I stayed for 3 months in a parish until I finally asked my provincial if there was an opening up here in North Jersey at a retreat house called Carmel Retreat, a beautiful mansion that we had bought back in the 50s, used as a retreat house, was now empty. And there were only two priests there. It was running on a shoestring. So I came there, began to have days of prayer. I gave workshops, began to start retreats. Gradually, some of the first people that came there, one of them is here today. That's Margie here. And Nellie, she's not here. Who else was there? Kay, did you come? No. Well, there were some that came from New Jersey, or rather from Long Island. It was a long trip. And were very faithful. And they were the ones who had me come over here. See? And that was back in 1974, 5, around that time. I started at St. William the Abbot. We met there a few times. Then we moved to St. James, and then where else? And then we moved here. And for at least about 10 years, I've been here. And gradually it's grown over the years, word has spread, and people have come and they like what they saw. Maybe some didn't like what they saw. Well, we lead them to the Lord. But I've given many retreats since that time. I think if I had to count them, it probably would be about 125 retreats since I'm here in New Jersey, in New York. And I've given married couples retreats. Some of you have been on that retreat. I haven't given one now of that kind for a number of years. I don't know why. I haven't pursued it. But I didn't get much of a response the last time I gave it, so I figured I should let it rest for a while. So I haven't got back to it. But it's always been blessed. Some of you here, I think, have been on that retreat. But it is a charismatic encounter retreat. That's what I've given. So that's got to be blessed, and it has been. And so my ministry grew from one day of prayer in New Jersey to another day over here. Then people that came to Bawa, where I was, asked if I would come to Westfield. So I did. So we started there. And then they asked if I could start one in Saddlebrook, where I was in residence, which I did for a while. Gradually moved from there to a retreat house in Saddle River, New Jersey. And then people came to Westfield from Trenton and asked if I would come down there. So I did. And then people came from Trenton to Trenton, came from Colts Neck, and asked if I would come there. So I went there. And so I was going to five places, and then I ended up at the Marian Shrine in West Haverstraw. The retreat master there invited me to come. And I've been there ever since. So that's six places. At one place, I've had to change. Eventually, there wasn't that much response. So I went now, and I'm going to St. Martha's in Point Pleasant, where we have a lot of retired people who are glad to have a day like that and come. So at present, I'm moving in six places each month on a mini-retreat day. Also, though, my healing masses have gradually developed. The kind of Mass you saw today has grown over the past 14 years. That wasn't the first kind of Mass I celebrated. But right from the beginning, we began to have healing. People were healed of warts. People were healed of back problems, relationships, depression. People were converted. There were healing of grieving. We had cases of cancer in remission. We had people with heart conditions that were healed. I had a Wednesday prayer group in my area, and the women came to that from 9:30 to 11:30, and we had many healings there. So then they invited me to have evening masses, and I have them in two places each month now, in my own area, Saddlebrook, St. Philip's, St. Immaculate Heart of Mary in Wayne. I've been there now 8 years, if not longer. And occasionally I go elsewhere. Meantime, too, I started a Lay Carmelite community, even up at Mahwah, 1973. Since that time, this is 86, I've had a lay chapter of Carmelites that I've conducted and spiritual director over these years. They are charismatic. That's one thing I ask them to be open to, and it's a very vibrant group. They're not closed to the charismatic gifts, so all my masses with them are healing. They are also fully into the use of the Christian prayer. So we say the evening prayer together, besides the rosary. We have a teaching. We have leaders among the lay members who do the teaching for the those that are going to be initiated as novices. And then further teaching I give to the entire group before the Mass itself. That constitutes our lay chapter meeting. And occasionally we have pilgrimages. In that time, too, by the way, I've undertaken to conduct three large pilgrimages, two to Palestine, one to Spain, Portugal, and France. And at that time we went to Avila in Spain, to St. Teresa of Avila's home, Madrid, to Segovia, St. John of the Cross's tomb, And then we ended up in Tarragosa on our way to the Pyrenees into Lourdes and visited there. And then we went to Lisieux, St. Teresa Little Flower, our basilica. I have to say I was there twice. Several times when I was in Austria, I came back. I forgot to tell you that I celebrated my 25th anniversary as a priest over there in the Alps. For that, I was allowed to come home for 3 weeks. And then I came home. You saw some of the pictures. And at that time, I visited some of the places on the way back and forth. And at that time, I visited Lisieux, also visited